Did you, you have any questions about the question?
I knew I'd figure that.
Any questions on what we talked about the other day? Further contemplation, reflection on it. Okay, we looked at looking at what science is, the theory of science, the logic of science, and we're still defining our terms. We've defined science in the narrow sense and in the broader sense. In the broader sense, it is explanation gained by sensory interaction with the world. In the narrow sense, it is what?
Method.
The methodology, the way of gaining information. And it is a limited way. One of the dumbest things about the age of scientism is that it is generally assumed that the only real, quote, end quote, way of gaining real knowledge is through science. That science is the fountainhead of all knowledge that is real, which is very, very narrow. A great deal of information, of knowledge that we have, is gained by all kinds of ways that are not scientific.
Wouldn't a lot of people, when they're guys like Carl Sagan, end up why the area of science, and they would say that it didn't have things to say on all these things,
yes,
and we narrow it down. If you're going to have a discussion with one of these kind of people, you're going to have to get all this straight, aren't you?
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
Now it would be like, he does like, he's given the theology, and the audience, the question of origins. Carl Sagan represents the popular science, the popular mind of scientism. Here you go, the opening of this cosmos to it. He's the main statement, for instance, that you go back to the ultimate, to the beginning. He says that if we do not accept the idea of God, then we must accept the idea of eternal matter. And the idea of eternal matter is no more and no less unbelievable than the idea of the eternal God, and since the idea of eternal matter is no more or no less unbelievable than the idea of the eternal God, there is no need to go back beyond matter to God. So he doesn't. Okay. You'll debate if you had eternal God or eternal clock. He opts for the eternal clock. Eternal matter. Well, that shows he's not a very good thinker. Well, he can.
Now that thinking that you just stated right there, that he would consider part of science.
Yeah, that's right, consider part of science. He would consider that scientific thinking. It isn't even good thinking. Remember I said the proposition of proof must be homogeneous? Well, he's comparing apples and oranges. What would you say about that statement? He said that the idea of eternal matter is no more or less provable or unbelievable than the idea of eternal God. Why should it be necessary to go back? Here's what he worded it, as I recall. We don't need to go back. There is no need to go beyond matter to look at the start of matter. But he could say, okay, you tell me, you say to me, I'm Carl Sagan now, Mr. Gossett, you point out that I cannot say where matter comes from, you tell me where God came from.
Certainly there's a danger.
principle of psychological dynamics. Well, there's two fundamental areas of thinking that if you're interested, you should be. If you're not, get interested. One is, if this word, there's a built-in fallacy in this kind of, I use it all the time. You see it in popular humanism. It's the word need. You don't need to go back. You see, you often hear at universities, especially undergraduate courses, you'll hear Christians refer to those who need a crutch. Why? You see, it's very commonly believed, or said anyway, that believers, like people like us, are people who live in God because of a psychological need. We don't want to be alone in the universe. We don't want to be. We're not content with that, but that's essential epistemology. We need the idea of a personal God. Well, that's a fallacy. That's the psychogenetic fallacy, if you study logic. The psychogenetic fallacy is that because even were true, is that you've identified why somebody thinks something, you have therefore disproved it. Well, I would point out, first of all, that when he says, why do we need to go back, that assumes something that's not true. That puts a twist on the debate. That is not a true twist. We do not go beyond eternal matter back to eternal God because of a need. As a matter of fact, you got that? No? Even if we did, if you say, this John Bell believes in God because he has a need, that does not prove that God does not exist. That's, by the way, this is exactly the argument of Robert Owen, even though I can understand what Robert Owen is, can't even debate. It's systematic. He thought he'd identified why people believe, he hadn't, but he thought he identified why people believe in God, but God does not exist. And then the common fallacy, you have logic. The genetic fallacy is that you judge an idea true or false on the basis of the source. That's genesis. The psychogenetic fallacy is the fallacy of denying X on the basis that you show why John will believe in X. This is why he believes in it, therefore it's false. Because if I believe, if Daryl Combs, if Daryl Combs believed in God for all the wrong reasons, every reason he had believed in God was opinion and irrational, it would not be the content not exist. So it would not be a content of belief. So you understand? So to suggest, here's what you suggest, this is the twist on that. The only reason anybody would go back beyond eternal matter, the eternal God, is some kind of psychological need. Now, the psychological, understand, need has nothing to do with it. And, if you want to act, but if you want to pursue that point, it is not the human inclination, it is not the universal human inclination to lean toward God, it is the human inclination to lean the other way. That is, if a man has a universal need, a psychological need, it's the need to get away from God. Not, man is not going hunting for God. God goes hunting for man.
But when you answer to that, a man's already been religious, folks.
And we never knew about it. That if we escape, you know, I would cite as circumstantial evidence of these universal worship of self. That is, if man has such a great psychological need, how come atheism and secularism has dominated our public institutions? Do you understand that man doesn't run toward God because of some kind of need? Man runs the other way. It's all belief, it's all instruments toward God. You coming? A man needs to not believe, especially a sinner. And you'll see this, by the way, when we look at this course. We look at, you see, when you study evolution, you see the overwhelming amount of evidence of God. I maintain, I'd actually show a debate. the man doesn't believe in God, he's going to be irrational. Why do so many otherwise rational people not believe in God? Or because they God said they don't want to. Whatever happens, me to you, I'm saying, that's a 100% anyway, that doesn't exist any more than at least. There's left there for every person who believes in God because he doesn't. For every person who believes in God because of a psychological need, you find 10 people who don't believe in him for the very same reason. So I'm not saying 1 to 10, you can get my point, I'm not putting statistics. Now, however, it looks a little wrong that argument. So I reject that word need. He says there's no need to go back beyond eternal matter to eternal God. But the fundamental flaw in his thinking is that the idea, the concept of matter, and the concept of God are not homogeneous. They are not equal. That's his fundamental fallacy, the basic fallacy. The other one's secondary. Why? Because there is built into the idea of matter certain qualities, characteristics, and this is where Scott's comment comes to the fore. That is, from what we know about matter, we find it very, that if we believe that matter is eternal, then we have to believe that matter, in some place, at some time, acts in a completely different way than we've always observed it to act. If matter is eternally degraded, if matter is eternal, and matter degrades at the known rate, then there is nothing here including us. Because if matter has been degrading at the known rate for eternity past, it is already degraded and we ain't here. Otherwise, so I'm not caricaturing anybody's position. They'll say, well, there must have been a time when there was some other physics operating. And we'll get this when we get into the theories. Somebody suggested writing a paper on the theories of the origin of the universe. We'll get into that. So that is, the clock wound up, ran down, to use the old analogy. Understand that? So, but there is built into the concept of God the idea of eternality. So eternal God versus eternal matter. Well, if matter is eternal, then there has to have been a time and place, at least one, the matter acting in a way he's never observed that. But so eternality is not built into the concept of the matter. Eternality is built into the concept of God.
Well, if matter was ever eternal, then that would mean it could be natural, right? If it's not natural, it could be
natural. Well, it would be supernatural, it would be abnormal.
Well, then, isn't that a fair objection to God?
Well, no, you can have abnormality in the natural realm, theoretically at least, without getting into supernatural.
Okay. It'd be another natural
way. Yes, it would be another natural way to put it. That is, and when you would have, because matter now is intrinsically degenerative, you would have to have a time when matter was intrinsically generative. Because we are here. You see, whether you believe it or not, you gotta have Genesis. You gotta have Genesis one way, someplace, because we're here. I think we are. Okay, I'm an aside, but we're commenting on his observation. It's a good observation. Now here's an example. He goes beyond science. You see, that is, it's like, let me illustrate it this way. I've done this in another connection. At one time, matter was generative. It went from low degrees of organization to high degrees of organization. The clock got wound up, as it were. Some kind of genesis. Because everything we observe now is degeneration. Second law of thermodynamics. What I'm saying is that at this point, we cross over from science to theology or philosophy. Because the theology, really. And Carl Sagan does, by his statement, he stands here and makes a comment in this area process, or a process to be scientific. We talk about scientific proof, and I have it in the thing here, a perspective, scientific proof. Science has proved, that's a favorite. That today is a religious statement for all practical purposes.
Science has proved that, and fill in the blank.
Now, what do you mean by scientific proof? Well, before we can say this, we must examine, give a context, a perspective of the categories of proof. Science, I point out here at the bottom of the first page, is only one category of proof. This is by observation, experimentation, and all the other aspects of the scientific method. But just to give it a perspective, I list on the top the other categories of proof. There is proof based on authority. Do you believe in heaven? Yes, I do. Upon what kind of evidence do you base your faith? The answer is authority. Why? Because Jesus has established his authority, and on his authority we believe the second coming. Now, his authority is another question. Upon what, you ask the question, on what does he base his authority? Then we go back to the resurrection. Understand? But his authority is the resurrection. On the basis of that, we accept as true his statement that he is coming back someday. That's what the Bible says. If we believe that God raised him from the dead, then we believe he's coming back. It's a biblical proposition. But there is proof based on logic. A logical proof is a kind of proof. It's limited based upon its assumptions, on the validity of its propositions. If it is true, that's not according to logic, but we can touch on this in other places. If it is true that all men are mortal, and if it is true that Socrates is a man, then it is true, deductively, that Socrates is mortal. Aristotle. No, but logical proof is that if, then you have a proof. And ultimately, by the way, all logic, I live here deductive and inductive, but really, with human logic, I'm not going to get into this with you because it's not the place to do it, but ultimately, all logic is deductive. If things are inductive and secondary things, but you arrive at your inductive logic, not human logic. All induction is expanded deduction. Then you draw deductions from here, you've got to be completely nevermind. But just not according to logic. Let me illustrate these three categories of proof. Scientific, authoritative, and logical. That if there's something, we know there's scientific proof, there's proof by authority, proof by logic. Let me illustrate it this way. One morning in the Garden of Eden, before the fall, Eve, being all woman, noticed a strange smirk on Adam's face. You know about this in the Bible, but this is pseudepigraphy. Copies of which were excavated as well. This has now been translated. Anyway. Eve noticed this smirk on Adam's face, and so she wonders if he's got something going on the side. He's seeing another woman. So she, being in her pristine perfection, she decides she can resist the night's battle. She decides I'm going to approach this scientifically, authoritatively, and logically. If she decides she wants to approach it scientifically, then what kind of proof would she get that Adam would be unfaithful to Adam and the woman? Observer, catch him a nap. He hides behind the tree of life. He's surrounded with hair, he is playing flat and middle with another woman. So, therefore, she has scientific proof. Why? She has observed it. But suppose she decides that's really going too far. She doesn't want scientific proof. She wants authoritative proof. How would she get that?
She'd ask God.
Or ask Adam. See, that's capital. Now, it's not as good as scientifically, that's capital. Now, would that be, if you could say you could say yes or no. But would that be, upon what basis would that be, quote, proved, end quote?
On his trustworthiness.
Yeah, on Adam's credibility, trustworthiness. Because Adam, but this is before the fall, you see. Because Adam, well, sin has not entered, therefore Adam tells the truth. Therefore, when he says, no, I've not seen another woman since he can't never sin yet, then she can accept that he's credible. Authority, but it has been there, she asked him. So he has logical proof. Yeah. What did she do? Yeah. Jesus said, I'm going to approach this through deep diving logic. She's the only one who's not creating. No other one there. Mm-hmm. What she does is, she really believes the word was his weights coming over the stage and half the grave. Right?
Okay.
Logical proof. Now, we should be sure, you see, he's missing one rib and he got me. If he's missing two, then if a missing rib means another woman, A, B, if B is missing him, you know, get a take proposition A, if Adam is, if the absence of a rib proves the presence of another woman, and B, Adam is missing a rib, then C, there's at least one around, there's another woman around somewhere, whether he's found her or not, I'm off. Plus, what you need is limited. See, that's limited, not another thing. But then that is deep up in logic. Now, you can get this too far, but that's, you know, that'll help you remember the three categories of proof: scientific, authoritative, and logical. But there are different kinds of proof.
What was the smoking about?
No, he was working about it. Oh, he's just happy. I don't know. Do y'all see that? So we don't. And if you ask a question that demands, if you ask a scientific question, then you don't get historical. You don't have any other kind of proof. You have to get homogeneous. Now, for instance, if someone says, show me God and I'll believe in him, what do you say? Show me God and I'll believe in him. What's the assumption behind that?
That God
will be able to do the human thing. You see, the fallacy in that is that whether there is a God or not, if there is a God, such as the Bible describes, he is, as the Bible says, not available to human senses. No man has seen God at any time he is today. By his very nature, he is not a human man. Therefore, by that test, you are making it impossible for yourself to believe in your God. That is, by requiring that if you show me God, I see God, I believe in him. What you're saying is, if there's a certain kind of God, then no one is impossible to ever come to faith. If the true God is beyond that test, that kind of test, then my rules of investigation will make it impossible to ever believe in him. That's why I've heard now, I'm not just being cute with it. A person who says, demand scientific proof of Christian faith, very often asking a question and wondering the kind of answer. You see, can you prove that God created the heavens and the earth with nothing scientific? No, not by the very nature of it, but the nature of the act rules it out. All you can show is probability, circumstantial evidence. So the person who asked that question is ruling out then, he's ruling out the possibility. Because he set up a stipulation that I will believe only under certain conditions, and those conditions automatically rule out reality, then your system, your method will keep you from reality. That's very true, but very much true in science.
For instance, I just finished a book which I'm going to bring to class and talk about when it comes to by the author of the steady state theory, Fred Hoyle. And Fred Hoyle says, very interesting comment, but he says, he's not a Christian, nor do they like that I should ever be a Christian, because I have not found clear evidence of God. This is a common statement to you. But I've not seen proof of God, therefore I don't believe. You see this very often. I've not seen proof. You're at the university, I've not seen proof of God. And when they say these are the scientific proof, I have not seen any scientific proof of God, therefore. And all they don't think this is proof, they don't really know what they're saying, because when you pass a lot of proof, you see. By setting up that rule, until I find scientific proof of God, by that they mean absolutely objective, completely objective proof of God, which they mean is, I set up in my mind a kind of world that would exist if God existed. That kind of world does not exist, therefore God does not exist. Well, what that does, it assumes, first of all, it would almost have to be God to have that mentality. Or the first of all, it almost have to be God, logically, to say, to construct in their mind the only possible world if there is a God. And the theologians, this is the best of all. It is, they also say things like this. But if there is a God, this is the best he can do. I don't want him anyway. If the world of present condition, you say, well, Jay Gould used that argument against creationism. He knows evolution. He invented evolution, at least in the tradition understood is absurd. But if God was going to create, why are there so many strange forms, awkward forms in the natural order? Surely, intelligent God would do a better job of it. What argument he uses? You talk about the panda bears opposing the sun and the Scottish elk and overburdens and antlers and things like this. Well, see what he's doing is he's saying, in effect, or in fact, that I know if there were a God, I know exactly what the world would look like. Since the world doesn't look like that, there can't be a God. Well, very presumptuous. That is, the world may look like it does for all kinds of reasons. We will love to fall without sin. What about built-in adaptability? You know, the presence of a mongoloid child, a Down syndrome child, does not prove that God does not exist. The presence of AIDS is just a true fact of proving ground. See what I'm saying? There are all kinds of possible explanations. So what they're really doing is, what I'm trying to teach you is a person who approaches it that way, I'm talking about these categories of proof, I'm not off the subject, I'm on the subject. What they're really doing is setting up, you can, by mixing your categories of proof, or by constructing your questions in such a way, that you can rule out the truth. If there were about it, you know, if I construct a test in my mind, whatever it is, this is commonly done now, if I construct a test in my mind, say, I have these 13 or at least 50 or 500 point criteria, which if there were a God, these would be met. Since the criteria are not met, there cannot be a God. What I'm really doing is I'm ruling, if the criteria are false, which they very much might well be, I'm making it impossible for myself to come to believe in the truth. Because if there is a God, and his presence indicates an alternate explanation to some of these criteria, or they're Googling some of them, or adding others. See, my list, my criteria, has
has made it impossible for me to believe. It's like a man saying, it's like a man, really, in every kind of thing. Women often do this, because women, I'm trying to illustrate my point here, and it's going to be something about Mary and I. Women are very sensitive. Women communicate with each other at a level that seems spooky to men. You know, a woman's got a real close friend, a girl, and a girl, and there's something bothering them. Her best friend knows it immediately. The boyfriend may find out week after next. It's too late. And often, the girl, a young woman, especially younger than they are, the more they do it. They're going to be mad at their, about something. Well, they get mad at their roommate. The roommate knows it instantly. But she'll be mad at the boyfriend. He doesn't know that she's mad. And so she'll play this game. If you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. Well, what she'll say is, now my best friend picks up on it because she cares about me. So she in effect says to her boyfriend, but without saying it, she thanks toward him. Now, I'm upset what you did. And if you really love me, you'll pick up on it. I'm just going to see. Am I right? It's exactly what they'll do. I'm going to see if he figures it out. Good luck. And so he's in trouble with us, don't you? You're married, tells us they're in trouble, didn't know it? Yeah, I've been telling them for 2 weeks before I found out. One time I was dead for a week. And so she's just going to see. And what she's doing, she's treating her husband as if he were another woman, you know. But what she's doing is she's saying, I've got this barrier. See if he gets over it. He doesn't want it there. I want to see if he does. She says it, if he doesn't touch me, he'll figure it out. If he doesn't figure it out, it's evidence that's why. He doesn't care about it. What happens if he failed the test, because you didn't even know he was thinking. It's hard not to pass the test that you know you're taking. But I promise you, she's not taking the test. You don't know you're taking it. You're going to flunk it. But what she has done is, because of her misunderstanding about men, that men have to be told twice, sometimes more than twice, before they send in. We're stupid. We demand language, words. and then we don't get it. Because what she's done, she's made the fundamental error of assuming that her boyfriend or her husband's mind operates the way hers does. She sets up a rule, a test of his love. And because the test is faulty, she may think she has discovered that he doesn't love her. As a matter of fact, he loves her very much. It's just that he is not in the position to pass us through the test. So, you think I'm making this up? This really happened. Well, you see my point? So, because her test is faulty, she may come to the conclusion that he doesn't love her, and that his love is real, very true. It just cannot be proved by that particular criteria. You can't tune into her subliminal suggestions. The man is broke. His mystery signal. Well, you see, and we do this in life all the time. For instance, we'll set up tests and we'll say, talking about categories of proof, how we think about things. And we have to keep our proposition and our proof in the same class. It's not what I'm trying to teach you. It's broad application. That is, often we will say, people ruin creatures this way. Often, you have some people in the church, they get a new creature, they will set up categories in their mind and say, he's a real preacher. They'll do these four things. The one I'm going to tell him. He's lucky enough to happen to do call the last people, preaching the last subject, and not preaching the last subject, and act a certain way toward him, and then he passes the test. But if he doesn't, he's not spiritual. We judge one another like this, don't we? We say, what we do, we can set up a test, even at the psychological level. At that level, we set up a test that rule out the truth. And understand? Because of a faulty question, faulty set of criteria.
That makes sense to you?
Well, now I maintain, I think I can demonstrate it, that atheism, that failure to believe in God, is a clear example of this, of mixing proposition and truth. Okay. Any questions on that before we move on? Well, next in our definition, we're going to define the Christian worldview of nature. Somebody read Psalm 8, 3 through 9. I don't have my other reminder questions, but you better do that. Psalm 8, 3 through 9.
When I consider thy heaven, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Yet thou hast made him a little lower than God, and hast crowned him with glory and majesty. Thou dost make him to rule over the works of thy hands, thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen and all the beasts of the field. The birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea.
Okay, look, as you see the nature of the universe, the nature of man. When I look at the heavens, I see you. I look at man. What is man? This created creature that you should even notice it. The greatness of God, the attitude of man. Now, that's the Christian worldview of nature. That is, that the natural order, not just the biological, the literal, the natural order is a product of the creation. It came from nothing. It was created by God. And that man is a special creation by God, in the image of God. That's why man, God notices man in the way he does not notice the cocker spaniels and the baby, by what John Edwards says. And I don't trust a man who smokes pot, goes and talks to flowers.
They talk about it.
That's the problem. They have much to learn from the pansies. Anyway, that's the Christian worldview. Implications. We're going to talk about the implications of the Christian worldview of nature. Number one. Nature exists for spiritual purposes. That is, the natural order is not just here by accident. It's here for spiritual purposes and is capable of a teleological explanation. Somebody tell me what teleological means. Will you tell me here, Professor? No, you tell me. Teleological. What's the word teleos mean in Greek?
End,
complete, finish. What's that? Teleo. What is it? What is the theological argument for God? Argument is found in one word. The word I prefer is more often the word purpose. And it is design implies purpose. It's created for something, isn't it? Yes, that's a fundamental question. Look at what is here. All the way, the farthest star, the farthest star system, to the smallest virus and amoeba on Earth. Is it just here? Just here? Or is it here for something? It is capable of a teleological explanation. Now you see, that's the fundamental question. Is it here for, does it complete a plan? Or is it part of a plan? Is it part of a design? Teleology. Now, to take this question apart, you would ask it at a reduced level. Do you see evidence of design in the natural order? We certainly do. One of the real problems that the evolutionists have. We're going to see later on that the idea of gradualism, neo-Darwinian gradualism, that tiny mutations operated on by natural selection over vast periods of uniform time produced minute changes which accumulated into larger changes which accumulated into species. Thus we have the origin of species, neo-Darwinism. One of your problems with that is that gradualism, we're going to see later, works with mathematics, but doesn't work with biology. Why? Because when you look at the complexity, the interdependence, the specialization, the particularization of biological order, for example, only biological order, you see design, you see teleology, you see organisms and organs which are clearly doing something they were designed to do. The eye seems to have been designed for seeing. The eye does not appear to be an organ that popped into existence and fortunately is able to see by some mere chance. It seems to have been designed for a purpose. So you see teleology within teleology. Biological teleology implies cosmic teleology. Proved and applied. And I like to read these guys.
Non-theists.
But they're trying to explain because they cannot. I did my professional time at the university. I said, have you observed, Dr. Jensen, that the author that you have in your reading, in the introduction to their books, they dismissed the idea of design, but then they used the language of design in the book. They introduced it to the back door. They dismissed God as a myth and introduced nature as a metaphor. And what the myth could not do, the metaphor does, is design its plan. And I said, have you noticed it's impossible to even talk about the reason to do that? Because it's impossible to talk about the natural order without the language of design. He said, you don't agree. It's impossible. What they do every once in a while is throw in qualifiers, they'll say. Well, let's stop now. This is not their word, this is what they're saying. Let's stop now and remind ourselves that all the design that we've been talking about is only apparent. It is not really designed, it only appears to be designed. Okay, there's a claim.
Mother Nature.
Yeah. Well, but they get away from that now, some modern books. For instance, give you an example. You take a foot. Let's take a foot. A foot. Toe. Now the foot, which works, by the way, the foot is a very complex instrument. Don't ever put down the foot. The foot can do more than kick footballs and get bunions. The bone structure is highly intricate. You balance on it. It's amazing. The foot is an engineering marvel. But see, the foot didn't start out being the foot. Why? We started out with nothing. The foot started out, depending on how far back you want to go, being, to use a generic term, an appendage.
I like that. Appendage.
Or something.
Greek appendix.
An appendage or something. For some reason. Now, we've got. Now, we're talking about teleology. Now, between the appendage and the foot is what?
That's the question.
Did the appendage get to be a foot? Did the appendage get to be a foot overnight? That is, this creature was some mesolithic. Well, this would have to be some. Barely post-Cambrian sea slug or semi-amphibian or whatever. I can talk about this in all matters. Went to sleep one night with an appendage that quivered. It's a cell called an accident. We'll grant the flipper. Make of argument. Somewhere between being a flipper and a foot. It was something in between. You should either flipper or a foot. Couldn't swim with water walking. Therefore, somewhere along the line, you had to have an appendage that was well on the way to being a foot, with no idea whatever of being walked on. That is, you know, they call this anesthetic evolution. That is, what happens is that different appendages by chance perform different functions, and fortunately, through some mutation, it got to be something to work on. But you see, it got there by accident. There could be no design. Therefore, when this appendage was, say, 3/4 of the way to being a foot, you cannot admit that there's anything behind it that is designing to be a foot. So it isn't a foot. But it's a foot for reason. It's an appendage. What is it? You get what I'm saying? That is, well, if there's no, there's nothing there, and if at this stage,
depending on how the teacher is,
if at this stage of development, there is no plan on walking, there's nothing saying, this thing isn't working this thing for walking, I think I'll do something better. I'm going to walk, I'm going to have to change this slipper, because when you get a run, there's nothing around planning, but although, here's my point, although there's nothing around planning on having a foot, you have to have a lot of, before you get a foot, you have to have a lot of antecedent evolution of organisms, of organs that are on their way to being a foot, but aren't a foot, and no matter how they're being a foot, it just somehow got to be a foot. And when they got the foot, it looked like somebody planned the foot, but they didn't. I mean, you really got to have rocks in your head.
Are we planning on keeping your foot, or the whale?
The whale went the other way. The whale went back to the water. You know, that's why it goes this way instead of this way. Let's take our break. Popped into my mind, and I went to the library to get them. Went to the catalog.
Did you? Have you had to find this document in handy to wade into your brain?
This book, I think of it, Peyton Crow. And I, what's that? I knew we had it, but we didn't see how the catalog is.
Pre-adaptation
is the word. Talk about teleology. You see, how do they get to different forms? Adaptation. Macbeth, Norman Macbeth calls the word adaptation the magic wand. That the evolutionists wave over all biological forms to explain everything. You got a cactus that grows an appendage that does not need for a bird, a different kind of bird. You figured that out. Adaptation. That's true. I like what these guys say. Well, that's adaptation. Well, what about the stages in between the appendage and the foot, where you have no purpose? You have to have pre-adaptation. Understand? You can't be adaptation because the flipper is useless. Anyway, this is on human evolution, my area of professional study. And let me read, this is Ashley Brace, C. Lauren Brace and Ashley Montague are two of the godfathers of human evolution. I mean, you know, we like can't move to that. Listen to this, evolution being opportunistic as well as cumulative. Rascal. This is called personification. Evolution being opportunistic as well as cumulative frequently takes advantage of structures developed under certain circumstances and uses them as a base for adaptation to change environmental circumstances. Mm-hmm. Very flexible. Such a condition is referred to as pre-adaptation. Pre-adaptation, the reapplication of structures originally developed for other purposes has accounted for some of the otherwise remarkable developments in evolution. Although, due to this point, I love it, it's better than Luke Henry. Although this should
should not be taken to indicate that there was any such preordained plan. Hmm.
They were talking about teleology.
Now, for instance, the eye, Ernst Mayr says, the eye obviously sort of asked in a pre-adaptive state was an organ that was going to do something else, all of a sudden, evolution being opportunistic, will say, hey, I haven't thought about it before, but you can see with this booger if you just give it a little adjustment here, and we'll. Well, if they can talk about being about nature, evolution just being opportunistic, I can talk that way too. So obviously, you had to have pre-adapt, and on the way to being something, if there's no design, obviously you have to have a process whereby it appears to be by design. Tell me. On the way from this to this, there appears to have been the foot appears to have been designed for walking. Does it not? The eye appears to have been designed for seeing. Let me read that again. Now this is I'm not scared. This I use it in university. It's very a bit outdated now, but it's standard work. Which, if you don't believe it, you just follow the term track. And this is simple nonsense, by the way. You should have recognized that as such. Evolution being opportunistic is doing. Such a condition is referred to as pre-adaptation. Reading in pre-adaptation, the reapplication of structures originally developed. Oh, sounds very teleological, doesn't it? Originally developed for other purposes. Now, wait a minute. Has accounted for some of the otherwise remarkable developments in evolution, although this should not be taken to indicate there was any such preordained plan. But if there's no preordained plan, how could it have been originally designed for anything? You see, my point is they cannot, even in their nonsense, they cannot talk about the natural order without the language of teleology. And so what you get God asked to leave because he's a myth. And then you get a metaphor of evolution doing all kinds of things. You got that? Originally developed for other purposes. Now that is a nonsense statement. If there is no teleology. Although this should not be taken as indicated with any such preordained plan. And then, you see my little. Then he goes on. The four fins of the early Paleozoic fishes. Were a pre-adaptation, four fins, you have four of them, The four fins of the early Paleozoic fishes were a pre-adaptation for later life on land. The four fins became legs and feet. The four fins of the early Paleozoic fishes were a pre-adaptation for later life on land. Although, it should be stressed, you gotta know how to read this stuff. I know why you get on that. Although, and then violin music in the same. Although, it should be stressed that their initial appearance was simply to enable the fish to function more efficiently in the water. Sounds like design, doesn't it? It was simply, listen to this, it was simply a matter of chance that it was later possible to modify fins. Modify? It was simply a matter of chance that it was later possible to modify fins into the legs of the earliest land tetrapods, the tetrapods of the water, pod 14. Listen, these guys are laughing at us. You know that. Hey, you got that? Another example of pre-adaptation. That is simple, logical nonsense, alone biological nonsense. I mean, it should be dismissed as logical nonsense before you even get to asking whether it makes biological sense. If I sound like I'm keeping ridicule on this, I just wanted to come up with exactly what I'm doing. This is ridiculous. I got examined in this, by the way. I want you to know that I am a certified expert in this. You know, it's really tough keeping a straight face sometimes. Another example of pre-adaptation. I'm serious. Another example, a lot of people think they got an education because they know a whole lot of white stuff. Another example of pre-adaptation is exemplified by the whales and dolphins we have previously mentioned. When their land-dwelling ancestor was made over, by whom, I ask? By evolution, I am told. Evolution does not exist. It's an abstract concept. It's a metaphor. Oh, never mind. Let's go on. When their land-dwelling... I think you got the reason. When their land-dwelling ancestor was made over for an efficient aquatic method of locomotion, whatever made over it did efficiently, the up and down capabilities of the spinal column were utilized, that means used, and adapted by whom, I ask again, as the mechanism for moving the propelling flukes of the developing tail. In this case, the type of movement, you understand that, you know, a shark swims like this, and a whale, a dolphin swim like this. The type of movement had, listen to this, originally been developed. That's the language of teleology, originally been developed for effective terrestrial locomotion, and then was remade, as it were, Well, that makes them all right, because as it were, you got to think about this. Remade, as it were, is pre-adaptation, because this up and down method, which is developed for effective terrestrial locomotion, which it is, I know. anyway, we'll grant that. As such, was remade, as it were, for aquatic propulsion. Flight versatile air mission. As such, the direction of the spinal column movement can be regarded as a pre-adaptation for its element. As such, the direction of the spinal column can movement this way can be regarded as a pre-adaptation for its subsequent use upon the re-entry into the oceanic environment, back to water. Again, we stress that there was no preconceived purpose involved. That last thing, while I go to the Smithsonian Institute, is a classic. We stress there was no preconceived purpose involved. Notice how nicely the whales swim, how efficient that is. But it's almost as if the former mechanism was redesigned for a very efficient aquatic locomotion. Isn't it nice how it worked out? What he's saying is, it was overwhelmingly clear that it was doing what it is designed to do. I cannot talk about it without the language of teleology. It's so amazingly efficient. Pre-adaptation makes no sense apart from teleology. But we must stress that there is no teleology. And I say, why not? And his answer would be, because. It's a very, you see the point? The word that keeps coming back to me is spooky. That is so irrational, it is spooky. And by the way, many, I believe that this is one of the reasons why the cutting edge of the restoration, Goldschmidt, and he
he's out of the way now, and Hoyle and Gould and Niles Eldridge, we're going to be talking about them later, are simply saying, let's cut out that nonsense. Now, this wasn't a textbook, was it? Let's cut out that nonsense and simply say that somehow there emerged a whole new form. Let's just admit that how did a cold-blooded reptile get to be a warm-blooded bird gradually? Let's just admit that a reptile is a master bird. Obviously, it's a fossil record, that's what happened. Let's just say it happened. Let's just cut the nonsense. Let's say that this creature is mated, and their baby had a foot. We knew how to use it. And four of them, as a matter of fact. Fortunately, also around the corner was another couple that also had a baby that had feet. Their baby with feet had a footed baby to marry, to mate with. You get the point. In other words, all you do is accumulate the absurdities. But what I'm trying to say to you here is that one of the reasons evolution is now, the theory of evolution as a metaphor, as a discipline, is in absolute chaos. It is absolute chaos because many of the godfathers have had all they can take of this kind of nonsense and said, let's cut that out. I mean, regardless of what our conclusions are going to be, this is nonsense. It is nonsense, yes.
I remember in my 10th grade biology class, my biology teacher was telling us that certain animals that came into being and adapted from a two-legged animal into a three-legged animal because it could run faster and survive better. And then it slowly adapted into a four-legged animal. Was she feeding me evolution? And I just didn't know.
Yeah.
never used the term evolution, but she was always saying adaptation. And I've always come to the belief that, animals can adapt to their surroundings.
Oh, within certain. Very limited. See. Yes. But you see, one of the assumptions of that kind of adaptation thinking is based on is this, one of the unspoken laws of evolution. I call it law of evolution, laws in quotation marks, but one of them is a need is a cause. Why did the animal have four legs instead of three? Needed four. But you see a need in the biological is uncaused. That's the kind of thing in popular kind of language. But the experts are just done about something like that. The need is not a cause. Why? Change is not coming about at all. The adaptation, the whole concept of adaptation, assumes that change has come about by need. That is true of evolution. We'll talk about microevolution and macroevolution later on. So I won't get into that. But adaptation is this magic wand that McGath says it is. And pre-adaptation is more of a magic wand. Do you understand? Pre-adaptation, this whole bit of nonsense which he just lays beside his way on him. But this excellent is an attempt to see if it can get qualified. There is no purpose, there is no design, no physiology.
Why did it have four fingers to begin with? It would have been more efficient
chance
to have six or eight.
And then more like a centipede, no problem. Or whatever. Yes, you see, chance. You can't read stuff like that. I used to point out to my professor after we got to know each other very well. That was nonsense. He agreed with what he Well, he said, the approach is, well, at least these theories, we don't. He said, you must understand how scientific theory works. They are useful. We use theories, you want to know how they operate. They say, we use this kind of thinking not because we think it's true, but because it's useful to lead us on to progress, scientific progress. But that's not what they're telling the kids in school. They're telling the kids in school it's fact in the textbooks. But they get, we know that this has problems, but you see, we use theories not as several truths but as methods and guidelines to further progress. And then we cast them aside. But in the meanwhile, we cast them aside and go on to other concepts. So pre-adaptation, it'll help us for a while we're, you know, getting our ducks in a row, and then we'll move on to something else. And they have, it's called punctuated equilibrium. We'll get to that later. But in the meanwhile, here's what they're doing. They're saying, yes, we realize that this won't hold up logically or biologically. It's just a tool that we're using. That's what a hypothesis is. It's a tool that we're using in our ever upward spiral of progress, scientific progress. But in the meanwhile, we'll put the textbooks as facts and tell the kids that if you don't believe it, you're stupid. Well, that's exactly what's going on. You got that? Well, that's really duplicity. About said a number of times, one of the things that struck me first in the university was the vast gap between what I call textbook evolution and the theory as it's held by the godfather, I call vast gap. You know, it doesn't know that you all took high school science, high school biology, or you took an undergraduate school. In some cases, graduate school. I tell my own son, hey, you ought to know that the experts, the big boys, they get together and laugh at this stuff that you're being taught. Very condescending, like this evolution of a horse, we're talking about that. G. Getter Simpson, they say, well, it's not, we know it never happened in nature, it's a darling of the textbook writers. It's in the upcoming edition of my son's biology text. You know, the evolution of the horse, from Neohippus, the modern horse, Equus. It's in the latest edition. The paleontologists have known for 60 years that that's nonsense. They've been saying it for 40 years. That's a fiction. Fossil evidence.
Why don't you or whoever go after that?
Well, it's been done. Macbeth is back in the 70s, pointed out. And then,
well, why does the word three? You pointed out to that.
I just had a go around with the man. In fact, he's the guy gave me the textbook because I pointed out this is really anti-education. And they said, well, you know, it's best to God. And they tried to get me off their back. I found out I'm off the hook. If I'd have forced a review of the textbook, it'd been very expensive, but it would have cost them. See, their problem is, and they admitted it, the guy who's in charge of the textbook selection for the whole area, the whole school system, their problem is, and I acknowledge this, their problem is, they say when you have to teach them this stuff, you document it, but my son's textbook just happened this year. How it came out was, yes, Dr. Chambers, we know you documented this, but we question that this is bad science. But we don't have anything else. All the textbooks have this. Here's the new one. It's either this or no textbook.
Now why can't there be a structure?
They say, well, they have no textbook. We're going to take the textbook as it is, because they all have this. They're all the same. Then they're right. They're all the same.
Why can't the teachers be instructed then?
You can never visit in public school.
It's not
religion.
Take religion out of state.
I've done this.
This is not true. Don't teach this for a fun book. As a teacher, I'll show you. Here it is. It's not true. You just skip over it.
They can't teach it. Can and they do do that, but often. I convince the high school teachers, because in their education, they have to study so much educational method and so little about their topic, that many high school teachers can't pass basic tests in their own field. And the fact that one reason they're trying to crack down on teachers, you know, only know how to teach what the method, but don't know what to teach. And because educators have been running the education system, it's all confusion. So now the emphasis is upon not on what you teach, but how you teach it. They infinitely multiply courses in how to teach. In my experience, I've been in the high school 2-3 times. In my experience, that in every case, I have had to teach the teachers the theory of evolution. They didn't understand that. They didn't understand the theory itself.
they couldn't, not only did not understand the creationist viewpoint or any criticism of it, they didn't understand the system. I mean, not to be unkind, that's true. Now, I'm sure that has been my experience in other cases. But my son's high school teacher blasted creationism in his hearing, so I don't object to a formal complaint. And documented it. Cost quite a story. But you can't. I pushed it as far as, if I'd have pushed it any farther, I would simply have been causing trouble for no, I made my point. I've been causing trouble for no reason, whatever, it would have been counterproductive. But when you get the head man admitting truth is defective, that's all we've got. That really bothers me, you see. But there was stuff in the textbook that was like a horse. I can show you. The scholars say that Together Simpson is the godfather of the godfathers. He called it, he said about this, the darling of the textbook writers. But of course, quote, it never happened in nature. It appears only to happen in the textbook. It's not this whole orthogenic evolution straight line. It's nice and neat. It's one of the primary proofs. It, you know, looks so clear. Oh, just to look at that nice orthogenic monophyletic progression. It creates a vision. And I'm going to show the same thing with the anthropology charts, which are a hoax. Not from a creationist point of view, but from an anthropologist point of view. Absolute hoax.
Well, there's this is a lot.
But you see how people are placed? But it creates a visual image. It's very convincing to people.
So the three third horse is one of the things that's going to have in terms of evolution of the horse?
Well, that's simply a nice, neat line. For instance, this simply does not represent any fossil evidence. For instance, the earliest one was the Hypocotherium, which wasn't originally classified as a horse at all. The Iohippus. Anyway, it's kind of complicated. But my point is, there's a great deal of dishonesty going on. But what got me off on this is that, let me get back to my main point. What about teleology? But this kind of stuff, which is standard, I call textbook evolution. I don't just mean this in high school, I mean in undergraduate school, even some graduate school. It's what I call textbook evolution, which is enforced by our courts now. It's the only theory of origin that can be taught. That it is full of this nonsense, and this is one of the areas of teleology. And that, here's my point, and that, this is my point of divergence this morning, that it is not simply creationists who are pointing out the absurdities of this way of doing business, intellectual business, and they have been crazy to point it out for decades. It is the evolutionists themselves who are crying out for a new concept. Neo-Darwinism is dead, except for textbooks. They themselves, I'm going to show you evidence of it, are crying out for a new concept because this is simply superstitious nonsense. And that's a really word. What you're looking at is superstition. That is naturalistic superstition. And yet, in the fact that if you saw this kind of level, remember I said the other day, you laughed. You thought, man, I don't know how serious you took it when I said if NASA practiced this level of science, that they would never got it off rocket past Diplo. You see what I'm saying? That is simply irrational. It has not only biological, you understand, not simply when you examine the biological forms, but when you examine the inner logic of it. If you accept their assumptions, it's still irrational. The intro logic fails. Okay. Nature exists for spiritual purposes and is capable of a teleological explanation. It does. We are not, and of course this gets into anthropology as well. We are not just here. We are here for something. And at the micro level, you have teleology. At the biological level, you have teleology. You clearly have teleology to the extent that nobody can talk about the natural order without the language of teleology. Hence the disclaimers thrown in, it's only apparent, it's not really a purpose, no really a design. We very clearly have a design, but we have no designer. It simply implies, that what my point being, that teleology in the biological level implies a teleological universe. The very existence of it implies teleology.
Second, so we're talking about implications of the Christian worldview of nature. Second, the universe is maintained by the providence of God. Paul wrote to the Corinthians about the idols. There are many lords, talking about these false gods. But there is one God by whom, this is 1 Corinthians, what is it, 12? Or 1 Corinthians 8, I should have, the discussion on idols. First Corinthians 8:6. For us, as opposed to the high pagan, there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. Paul says in Colossians, in him all things consist, so that the universe is maintained by the providence of God. I indicate the impossibility of pantheism. What is pantheism? This is the new age thing. This is where we're heading now. We're moving away from secular humanism to cosmic humanism to pantheism. I've got a book. The latest book by Fred Hoyle is pantheism. It's called The Intelligent Universe. There's no intelligent God, but the universe itself is intelligent. This is Hinduism.
It's somehow a living being.
Yeah. Somehow it's a monistic concept that somehow all nature is of the same order, all things, man, plants, animals, in a stone, and that the only difference is in degree. There are no generic differences, only differences in degree. All levels of command is the highest level of consciousness, but if you go down to the rock, who's to say a rock is going to have some level of consciousness? You step on a bedbug, it has some level of distorted consciousness at least at some time. And that there is a quasi-divine spirit interpenetrating all is one. Now the force, evil and good are one. Different sides of the same reality. This is Star Wars. Star Wars is pantheism, New Age thinking. The song I mentioned before, I started, we are the world. You know, the ethic is not love your neighbor, but be your neighbor. By saving the children, we save ourselves. It's a pure nonsense, pantheistic nonsense. If there's no I, thou relationship, as Martin Buber says, everything is I. I am a part of the great I. The world is one mother's self. Anyway, this is pantheism, and it's coming. If you go to a New Age bookstore, holistic health is a part of it in some aspects. And I remember my sermon, I talked about the idea of the man is God, can do anything. What the mind can believe, the man can achieve. That kind of nonsense. And the extremes in this, you have university professors now teach extremes that if we really hit the mind in the right groove, we can practice levitation, out of the body travel, overcome the physical world. Why? Because it's all a part of one reality, and we can move from one level of reality to another if we just get in on it. Christian science, it's pantheism. That is, but you see, my statement in the syllabus is the impossibility of pantheism. Why? Because again, it's simple nonsense. We are not God. There is in the universe, as Paul says to the Corinthians, many kinds of bodies. We're not all one. There are different aspects of reality. There is not simply, and there are separate realities, not simply one reality. That all the universe is not simply different levels of emanations from the divine, from the impersonal divine. The universe is not divine, and we are not God. Pantheism is simply pantheism. The growing pantheism, New Age thing it's called. Are you familiar with this? You taught this. Does Professor Dean Chambers deal with this? Sure he does. Good. This is an overlap. That this is.
This is evidence of the extremes to which man will go. Fred Hoyle's book, I'm going to talk about, talk about the origin of the universe. It's clear evidence of the extremes that man will go to avoid the obvious. That is God. It's amazing. It's one guy said, who is it that said? Pantheism is clear evidence of. I'll lay this on. There's trouble on a piece like this. The things keep popping into my mind that I haven't written down in the past year. Sit. This is working. We call the source. The statement is this. Class, I'm going to write this down. Class statement. And they're talking about the impossibility of pantheism. The statement is this. Now I'll get the source for you later. The man who stops believing in God. The man who stops believing in God does not start believing in nothing. The man who stops believing in God does not start believing in nothing. Got that? He starts believing in anything. That's great. That's what the whole court of attrition papers is. That whole thing is what the whole. Anything out, that's it. Man who stops believing in God does not start believing in nothing, he starts believing in anything. All right, you got it. What do you think about that? That's pantheism. Isn't that good? That's classic pantheism. A man, and this is clear, the New Age, this rise in pantheism is clear evidence of that, of the truth of that statement. The man who stops believing in God doesn't start believing in nothing, he starts believing in anything.
Out of this theory, everything can come under there. Someone who is truly pantheistic and say, "Time, if you're a creationist, if you believe in the Bible, hey, it's all one thing. You believe that, I'll believe that, you can do whatever you want."
Well, that's not really it. That's not really it. The point he's getting at is that with the. Here's what he's saying. I see what you're saying. What you're saying is true.
It goes. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
But that's not really the focus. What you say is true. It's not the focus of this statement. It's this. Biblical theism is overwhelmingly the only rational explanation, the only rational worldview. Therefore, when one overthrows biblical theism or something corresponds to biblical theism, he has to become so irrational that he will start believing in the irrational. And the degree to which he accepts it is increased by its irrationality. He starts believing in anything. Anybody who can understand pre-adaptation is a concept that is so irrational that, from a biological point of view, no matter what point of view, whether creationist or evolutionist or whatever, and as I say, many leaders are saying it's irrational, many, it is so irrational that the question is, who would believe that? Who would put stuff down in the book like that? I'd be humiliated. Anything like that in the book, put my name on it, sell it. Anybody read it? I mean, you know, it's just like admitting you got herpes. Who would say humiliating, you know, be that irrational? So, what he's saying is that this is human nature, Romans 1. God is the reprobate mind of Romans 1. That when you stop, when you refuse to have God in knowledge, you end up in pantheism. Or something like that. The man who stops believing in God because of the very irrationality of that doesn't start believing in nothing, he starts believing in anything. I made a statement long ago, before I went to university, and said evolution, that show me an evolutionist, and I got a bridge I want to sell that's in Brooklyn. I mean, anybody would believe in that, wouldn't they? I'm serious. It is so irrational. That really it takes a, I was told my professor, and he understood what I was saying. I mean, he didn't. I said, we were pretty good friends before I laid this on him. I said, I'm not, I am less of an evolutionist now than I was when I started this.
studying under you. And I said, the reason is, I'm not religious enough to be an apparition. He knew what I meant. Takes more hit. I'm just not that religious. I don't have that much faith. I simply have not come to the point where I can believe in anything. I have to believe in something. You see the point in that? I mean, it's very true. And pantheism, my point here is that this growing pantheism, this New Age thinking, is a clear example of this statement. I cannot find the source. Man, the archetype. That's classic, if you think about that. It shows the credibility of biblical epistemology. That's exactly what the Bible says, not in those words. Here's the point. The Bible picture, Romans 1 in particular, pictures unbelief as a unbelief is a philosophical matter, not a scientific matter. That is, why do men not believe? They like to say, well, I would believe, but I can't believe. But men do not believe because they can't believe. They do not believe that they will not believe. They refuse to have God. Unbelief springs from the will. The will to believe. And of course, a lot of Christian evidence people work on the will to believe. Or other areas of study which we'll get into. But
I was talking to one guy, it was like 3 or 4 minute discussion, and I posed a question that, you're God, you've got something to say to me, how are you going to do it? And the Jewish guy on my left said, I'm not going to touch you. Because in a second or less, he knew exactly what I was getting at, and he knew it couldn't be refused.
Yeah.
And so the light came on, but still, it had nothing to do with his willingness.
I asked a colleague at the university when I was a fellow student. He said, I asked him if he believed in resurrection. He said, no, right away. I said, the historical doubt, unbelief, or philosophical? Is it objective or subject? Mostly it's object. I said, are you saying that you don't believe it and would not believe under any condition? Or that you think it might have happened but didn't happen? And I said, under what conditions would you believe it? If Jesus and those were there, what kind of evidence would you accept? Not for a long time. Because you understand that your unbelief has nothing to do with evidence or science or history. It's simply a notion. It is therefore worthless.
No, I mean, he's a friend of mine. He met me. This was a friend of discussion.
I was trying to teach him. And he acknowledged it. You know, he hadn't thought about it. He's not thought about it that way before. But see, the point is, one of the things I want you all to see is that we as Christians have, and one of the things, one more statement that I'm going to quit. We have simply got to stop apologizing for our faith as if our position were the least likely to be true, but nevertheless is true.